there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. It's episode 245. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send that email on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. We tweet, you know, every now and then. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a show we have for you this week, and away we go. Now, if you'll recall, not 2 weeks ago, our good friend Netta Ullaby was on our show for a fifth time, and she said, Ken, there's so many other amazing gay folks working at NPR, you have to get them on, your listeners would just love them. So days later, two of them said, yes, of course we'll be on, and then they decided they wanted to be on together, which I'm hoping is not fear-based, but we'll find out. Let me introduce them to you. Zoe Chase is a reporter for the incredible team that we all know as NPR's Planet Money. She started out at NPR working as an intern on Weekend Edition Sunday, and then developed a beat covering popular music as part of NPR's arts desk. She also co-created Pop Off, a regular feature about hit songs for Morning Edition. Also joining us, Sonari Glinton is an NPR business desk reporter based at the NPR West Bureau. He covers the auto industry, consumer goods, and consumer behavior, as well as the marketing and advertising. He's tackled big stories, including GM's road back to profitability and Toyota's continuing struggles. He was formerly a producer for All Things Considered, and prior to journalism, had a career in finance. They are both here with us now. Zoe, Sonari, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
It's good to be here.
So I have to ask, I'll start with you, Sonari, what happened in the email correspondence or phone correspondence between you and Zoe that led to you both saying, we want to be on together?
Well, you know, it's really funny that we talk all the time, two, three, four times a day. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
And we didn't know that we were both supposed to be on the show, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we're like, you know, it's really funny as I think I can speak for Zoe in this, is that as, you know, as out front as we can be, you know, like being on the radio and stuff like that, there's a bit of us that's, you know, there's a bit of like serious introvert that's a part of both of our personalities. And we're like, well, at least we can lean on each other.
There you go. And you confirmed that, Zoe, it wasn't fear-based that you guys had to be on together?
No. Like, quite the opposite. I mean, I think what happened was Sonari and I, we talk pretty regularly about some of the common anxieties that can come up in our profession. And I said to Sonari, when he called me at one point, like, angsting about something, go listen to the way Netta's talking about you on this, like, random gay show. Because you'll feel better. And then we realized that, like, what Netta was, like, sort of surreptitiously, like, unspoken but, like, clearly intending to do was to sort of showcase the friendship between Zoe Chase and Sonari Glinton, which the world hasn't really gotten a chance to see. And so we kind of, like, received that message after we discussed it over the phone, after we listened to what Netta was saying about us, and we're just kind of carrying it out.
Are we working towards a joint show, the two of you? When's that happening?
I don't think we've ever... You know, it's funny. I don't think we've ever... I think there are very few people... Like, if I walked out into the NPR West and I said, you know, one of my best friends is Zoe Chase, they'd be like, really? I don't think the people here know, and I think that might...
They want to know. They're dying to know who Zoe is friends with. So, we can't. So that's why we kept it, you know, undercover.
I see. That's totally cool.
We're coming out on your show.
Okay, this is very exciting. I feel it's breaking news for a very specific audience.
Yeah.
Great.
You have that right.
That's great.
We're really targeting this.
Oh yeah.
General audience.
That's what we do. All right. Well, Zoe, we'll start with you as we take a couple steps back as we start with our guests. Talk to us about why the medium of radio for you, Zoe, to use your voice. Why have you chosen this medium to make a difference in the world?
I did not choose it to make a difference in the world. I chose it to be selfish because I just like enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to the radio, and then I enjoyed producing the radio. I did feel like I was making a difference in the world when I was a special ed teacher, but then I went and did radio, and I don't really feel like I'm doing the world a service. But I will say that, like, it turned into one of, like, the great joys of my life, just to, like, tell specific stories, to tell stories in a way that you can only tell on the radio, which is kind of, like, the way that you only talk to someone, like, on the phone, you know, this sort of, like, confiding, basically trying to bring somebody to a moment just through your own description and your own feeling and excitement. Like, that was a big part of, like, how I lived my life anyway. Like, my favorite thing to do was just, like, go to the bar with a couple of friends and, like, get real deep. So, you know, it turned into my, like, job, which is nice. And I will say that, like, that part of my extracurricular life, which is just, like, getting real deep with my friends, has kind of just turned into, like, talking to Sonari on the phone.
Nice.
Just kind of, like, making radio.
Yeah.
In general.
You're doing it right now. You're doing it right now. What about you, Sonari? You have this background in finance. Why the medium of radio for you?
Well, I think that I'm a big city kid, like Zoe. I'm from Chicago. And there's something about radio that was really, really important to me. And I never thought that, like, I would be able to tell stories. But, you know, I listened to a lot of pop radio. I listened to a lot of, you know, as a kid, you know, hip-hop was, you know, coming on the scene when I was a teenager. I got really involved in, you know, like, old-school jazz. And I just found myself that being, that was the thing that I, that was constant, that mm-hmm. I was listening to the radio. And I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I had a whole other career, and September 11th happened, and, you know, I got laid off, and I was surveying my life, and I'm like, what do I want to do? And I knew I wanted to be a journalist, and I sent an email. I remember sending resumes and applying to every single journalist organization in Chicago, and not one of them even, like, responded. And finally, eventually, public radio was the only one with that would have me. So
there you go. There you go. Well, that worked out. That worked out pretty well. Now, Zoe, we will ask you the question. Sonari gets a little bit of time to plan for his answer, but you get to go right away.
Go,
we will ask you the question we ask our buddy Netta and the always beautifully coiffed Ari Shapiro. How does the being gay piece play into the work that you do there at NPR?
My voice.
Your voice. I don't know if I should run with that or not. I'm going to let you run with it.
People say I have a gay voice because I do, because in seventh grade, I basically decided to drop it like about two octaves to speak more like Demi Moore on Ghost.
Nice.
Was my thought, that kind of throaty, seductive way that she speaks. And so I dropped my voice down a few notches. And I think that has, you know, I think that also has to do with my sexual orientation. And then, and now I do radio, and my voice is the only way that people know me. Like,
yeah.
That's how people know me. So it's like a huge, you could say it's like a huge part of my reporting, even though it's not something that I ever talk about because I don't need to.
Your voice is pretty integral to your reporting.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
Everything.
What about you, Sonari?
Zoe and I have a mutual friend who once said to me, I'm a Japanese Jewish lesbian. There's not going to be a lot of me in the room. And I remember connecting with that idea because I'm a gay black man in public radio.
Right.
I am never going to walk into a room, especially in business, and be on the inside, or politics, or whatever. I always sort of feel like an outsider, and that's a strength because I'm never going to get that chummy
right.
with people I cover, though the auto industry is really super gay. But I'm never going to be completely on the inside, and I think that allows me, you know, that gives me a freedom that I think a lot of my reporter colleagues, you know, don't have.
Yes, you were mentioning that in an email, that the upcoming auto convention show is not even, ironically, quite the gay fiesta.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, you know, there's design, there's journalism, there's marketing, there's PR, all those things which come together at an auto show are where people put on the show. Well, a lot of the people putting on the shows are gay, and so that's an interesting part of it. I remember going to the auto show in Los Angeles, and Volkswagen had a display, and they had these beautiful men wearing white shorts and striped shirts and passing out sunglasses.
Huh.
And I was like, this is the gayest thing I have ever. This is like, I can't believe how gay this is. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. The guy who's in charge of this is gay.
Look at that.
And then the other guy who's below him is gay. And then, you know, I realized, and oh, no wonder all these guys are so good-looking, because the person who's hiring them is gay. I mean, it goes a little deeper than that, but all the major auto magazines have a senior editor who is gay, at least one. And so, you know, it's really funny that, like, Road and Track and Automobile Magazine, like, what influences those magazines are gay men.
I had no idea. Now, I will tell you both that I tried to do for you both what we just did for Netta a few weeks ago. I went back, because there's all these, you know, it's the beginning of the year, the end of a previous year, and there are all these top five, top ten lists. So I put together for Netta her top five gayest stories of 2013. So to be dutiful, I tried to do that for both of you, and I struggled a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Netta covers arts and culture.
Yes. I tried, though. So I was able to put together both of your top two gay stories for 2013, but it's a bit of a stretch. So for you, and this is how bad this is, for you, Zoe, I had the number two story. It was the story about chips, beer, and tweets, why TV is key to Twitter's prospects.
Mm-hmm.
And I only felt that was gay because it very much entertained me how much everybody was tweeting during the Sound of Music special. So it was not good. And then the other one, your number one, Zoe, was a little bit more literal. I put as your number one gay story, Robin Thicke's song sounds like Marvin Gaye, so he's suing Gaye's family, because the word gay was just right there in there.
Well, that is definitely why I chose to do that.
Nice. That was very validating, Zoe. I appreciate that. Yours was a little better scenario, but really not a ton. I felt that the end of the year Edie Gourmet story was your number two gay story of the year. Because
that's the gayest story anyone has ever done. Are you kidding?
Wait, sorry?
You, that's number two? That is the gayest story anyone could ever do.
There's a lot of gay appreciation for Edie Gourmet.
Yes.
Oh, Edie Gourmet, yes.
That is the gayest story. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, now I want to switch them, and I'm not feeling really great about my number one choice. But
was it my Subaru story?
Oh, that would have been good. And you would think, I just moved from Vermont. It should have been the Subaru story. No, it actually was, in all seriousness, I loved the bit in your story about the Chicago high school students cheering for Obama's speech. I really appreciated the piece of that story where the students were genuinely touched when President Obama gave a shout-out to what he would do for the LGBT community.
Oh, that's so interesting. Like, I totally have an amnesia about that because I completely forgot.
Didn't you do a story where you talked about how good you look in a pair of jeans?
I didn't say how good I looked. I did
yes,
a story.
You did.
No. I did a story where that was a while ago. I said these jeans, they're hot or something like that.
Yeah, you're like, I look hot in some jeans. I don't even know how you managed to like work that into a business story. But somehow it's like, by the way, looking good in jeans, scenario in the NPR News. That's how I remember that story.
I would like to remind our listeners that this week's episode also serves as the debut, as you just heard, of Scenario and Zoe's new show, because they're doing it right now. It's happening right now.
I did a story about jeans in Los Angeles, and the woman who, Elsa Metchik, who is not gay, but who is the most fabulous person I've met, she pointed out my jeans in the story, and I thought that was pretty hilarious.
That's pretty good.
In the story.
That's pretty
put
good.
In that part.
I put in that part, yes. She's like, it was, and the dude who's the head of AG Jeans, that fancy jeans company, Jason Koo, might be one of the most attractive men I have ever interviewed.
Nice.
I was
nice.
Participating while I was interviewing him.
Well,
and he's very straight, too.
And he's very straight. Well, I did go back a few years because you guys have covered such a wide range of LGBT content in your time at NPR, and some highlights as I saw them, and you might have other ones, and I'm sure you do. Zoe, I have to tell you, I enjoyed immensely, and because it personally touched me as well, because your experience very closely mirrored my own, your story covering the closing of the Oscar Wilde bookshop.
That was my very first radio story.
Was it? That was a very gay start for you, Zoe.
It was so gay.
That's See, you're on the right
I'm
show.
I'm shocked by it now. I'm scandalized. I don't know. I mean, it's just like, it was just one of those, it was one of those things where, like, in a way, even though, like, I don't really necessarily like to talk about myself, especially in, like, a professional context, if you're learning how to do something like radio, and like I said, you know, I think of radio as this very personal, intimate medium, then the way to begin would be to begin by telling a personal story. I mean, that was sort of the easiest way for me to start, I guess, in radio, was to tell a very personal story.
That was a great story. That was, I remember going there, and I remember just being an undergrad at NYU and going into that store kind of sheepishly and nervous, and it was just, it was a big deal when it closed, and you memorialized that in a really lovely way. Now,
thank you.
I do know
now,
that...
Now like a really gay furniture store, but that's just like not quite the same refuge.
No, it's not the same.
It was as a bookshop.
It's not the same. You did take, I will say, we don't really go towards anything controversial on our show, but you did take a slight bit of flack on the internet. It was fun reading about it. I don't know how fun it was for you. You'll tell me. Your story.
I have read it, so I don't know.
Oh, great. Well, then nothing happened, and everyone enjoyed your story called Why Do Some Women Perform in Character?
Ah, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Did you have any sense that there perhaps was some pushback on that story?
Yeah, but, like, I wasn't actually interested in, like, a dialogue with random internet weirdos, but I was interested in kind of how drag queens felt about stars like Beyonce, sort of, you know, I mean, it's not like Madonna didn't, you know, like very, like obviously pull from drag queen culture, but just like that was almost more explicit than I felt like what was happening at the top of the pop charts with like the advent of Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
So I was more interested in hearing what the drag queens had to say, but I don't really trust the internet to weigh in on like how, you know, a drag queen's view on something.
Right.
So,
that's probably a safe bet. Yeah, that's probably a safe bet. Now, Sonora, you've had a number of just incredible stories, but I have to point our listeners towards a piece that you wrote called Gay Life Gets Better with Age. And it's just a lovely piece. I want to read from it real quick. You wrote, quote, "As a gay man, I've often needed people to give me guidance, but the sad fact is that the men who could have or would have served as examples for my life are often dead. Sometimes we forget how colossal and horrible the AIDS epidemic was and is. In the absence of gay role models older than I've done what people do, I make do." Let's just start with the first level. It's a beautifully written piece, Sonari.
Oh, thank you.
What prompted you to write that?
It was around the time of the It Gets Better campaign,
mm-hmm.
and I was watching these, you know, I watched a couple of these videos, and then I start thinking, like, I don't know of any, I have this good friend who's, who I wrote about in it, my friend Tommy, who is, like, you know, in his early 20s, he just got married, and I was like, I can't imagine someone Tommy's age, like, really caring that much about what these middle-aged guys were saying in these It Gets Better videos. And then I thought, you know what, there's something good about it. I don't know what's good about it, and let me think about it. And I realized that it was for the people who were doing the videos. Like, that's where the work was being done. And that my hope was that maybe, you know, you would do a video and then get involved in the life of someone who was having a hard time. And that was sort of what I was thinking of. What is the good thing about it, this? Because there's something that's a little off-putting about this campaign, and I didn't know what it was, and I sort of tried to explore it in that essay.
I love it. People can look that up. It's called Gay Life Gets Better with Age. So go Google that, folks. Now, one of the fun things about having Netta on, having Ari on, is that it's incredibly validating because they always have great stories of when the technical things go a bit awry, because I don't know if it's happened to either of you ever, but sometimes in radio there are some technical issues. So we'll let you guys tell some of your fun ones, and we'll start with you this time, Sonari. Tell us about one of those times that the technology would just not cooperate with you.
Well, you know what? It's funny. I don't really have – it's not necessarily that the technology fails. It's that I fail. You know, I've gone to interviews and not had batteries. My favorite one, here's one, and this is an important lesson. Nick Spitzer has a public radio show, and when I was very, very new, they asked me to do a tape sync with the renowned singer Jerry the Iceman Butler.
Which just means, like, somebody, you know, you had to go record the guest in person so they could talk to the host and it could sound like the host was in person.
Yeah,
right.
So yeah, I'm recording Jerry the Iceman Butler with my recorder, and Nick Spitzer's talking to him on the phone. And this was how long ago. I was supposed to mail the tape, and they would sync them together so it sounded like they're in the same room. And I didn't, like, check out the equipment, and I didn't realize it needed 4 batteries instead of 2. So the number one rule of a tape sync is you don't shut off the recorder. Like, you just don't do that. And I kept, like, every time he would go into this fabulous answer, and then it would stop. And finally, I had to go and I kept getting batteries from his secretaries and things like that. It was such a colossal disaster that the producer, who I have lost touch with and who I thank for my career, sent me back to do it over again to teach me a lesson. And it taught me a lesson for the rest of my career. But the good part was that I covered the Cook County Board of Commissioners, which is Jerry Butler, a Grammy Award-winning singer, and a public official.
Of course.
So in Chicago, Moon River was his hit. His secretaries took pity on me because they thought I was like a moron, right? Because they're like, oh, Sonari, you know, you have to get those batteries all the time, or he doesn't know what's up. So, you know, here's the schedule for next week, or no, they're meeting over there. And so, like, literally the people, like, it was one of the best moves I ever made, was like appearing like a moron.
I love it.
For the rest of the time that I covered the county board, those women would laugh at me and then help me out.
Nice. That worked out just fine.
Eventually.
Eventually. We're all patient. What about you, Zoe?
I don't know. I mean, like, I wouldn't say that it's, like, the technical screw-up. Like, I have so many mistakes that I make, and the technical side of it, I'm always, like, over-prepared. Like, I bring a lot of stuff with me, except, like, yesterday when I went to the hospital that I was born at, actually, Mount Sinai in New York, and I was doing a story about Medicare perverse incentives. And, like, it was basically this, like, nerdy doctor was doing a training of these EMTs, and it was clearly, like, already in kind of an awkward situation. Like, the EMTs were not really trying to hear it, and the doctor was, like, really nervous and not a great presenter. And I was just, like, up in the mix with my shotgun, which is like a mic that is like kind of a long mic.
Yeah.
And the doctor basically stopped his presentation in the middle, and he was like, this mic is making me so nervous, like, I can't do it. And I thought that he was like gonna freak out. And I was like, oh my God, like, what am I gonna do? Like, I have a job to do, and I feel like it's more important than your job, but that's not actually true. So he was wearing, though, a lavalier mic, which is like just a mic that you clip on, and it's a great kind of microphone to use when somebody's giving a presentation and, like, you don't want, you know, necessarily your mic, like, right up in their face.
Right.
And especially if they're, like, on TV or something anyway. I was, like, I made the decision to just, like, sit back, let him talk, and I went to the video guy that had put on the lavalier mic, and I was like, can I use your audio? Because I just felt like that would be more efficient, and I was clearly, like, really upsetting this man who was going to cry. And so I just got the tape back from the lavalier mic, and oh my God, like, it sounds terrible.
Ugh.
It sounds so bad, and I'm just sitting there with it, like, so embarrassed. Like, why didn't I bring my own lavalier mic so that I could have been prepared, you know? But, like, I don't know. Like, now I'll bring a lavalier mic. But, I mean, I still am just making so many mistakes, you know, even though, like, I do this job. You know,
that makes me feel so much better. Well, let's end with, we love giving advice to our listeners. You know, every time we have an NPR person on, we always get listeners saying, oh gosh, I want to do what they do. I want to get into radio. What advice do you have for our listeners, Sonari, who want to do what it is that you do?
Well, when I was trying to figure that out, Ira Glass had a comic book, and I literally followed what the comic book said. If you want to work in public radio, no, no, seriously, at the back of the comic book, it had, like, if you want to get into public radio, this is what you do. You have to intern somewhere for free. After you've interned for free for a year or two, someone will hire you for a job that you're overqualified for
right.
on a part-time basis. After you do that for a year or two, then you'll get hired permanently for a job that you're overqualified for, and then you're in the running. But it's sadly for, I mean, the best way is to work at a member station, to go and intern for free for a bit. And then, you know, once you have bitten the leg of public radio, don't let it shake you off. that's the only.
There's the image.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is the only reason that I'm here and all the great talented people who were interning alongside with me was that I had more stamina.
Nice. What would you add on to that, Zoe?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, that was the script that I followed. I would just say that, like, I talk a lot about how I kind of, in radio, like, my role model always was Kanye West. You know, he was a fantastic producer. Like, he was such a great producer that finally, like, when Rockefeller Records was trying to sign him, they had to also sign him as a rapper. Because he had proved himself so much as a producer, they had to take their chances with him as a rapper. And I use that as a model for myself in that, like, I did want to be a reporter, but I tried to be such a skilled and exceptional producer that, you know, like, people would sort of be willing to take a chance on me with my reporting, with my stories. And so a lot of times what I tell people is just to kind of, like, act like you have the job that you want, and eventually you get paid to do that job. So before I was hired as a producer and I was an intern, I just acted like a producer until finally somebody started paying me to produce. And then before I was hired as a reporter, I just was, like, acting like a reporter, like, doing stories on, sort of on a beat, as though I had been assigned a beat, which I had not. So that's another way to go about it.
Little known fact about Kanye West, Zoe, he also lowered his voice a couple octaves in the seventh grade.
Well, that is probably why I got so successful, just like Kanye West.
Do you sometimes get sick, Zoe, of people just comparing you to Kanye West? Is it tiresome?
No, it's not. I never tire of that. I welcome that. That should continue on.
I love it.
Or begin, I guess I should say.
I love it.
Not happen.
Well, I have to ask you both, and you can lock in your answers. You have to lock them in separately because you're in different places. But as we are, not if, but when the new talk show comes out featuring both of you as hosts, what do we want the theme song to be? Okay. So we got to lock in our answers. I'm going to start with you, Zoe. What describes this relationship? Also, I mean, this question to break you two up, so let's keep that in mind.
No, like, the first thought I had was Beyonce's Irreplaceable.
Look at that!
Which I was like, Sonari, like, don't you for a second think that you can't, you don't have to work at being my friend. But that's not really true. I'm, like, really dependent on Sonari. I really need him. And I feel like Sonari actually knows what the theme song is. And I think it's, like, a Sammy Davis Jr. song. And it's, like, get happy, don't hate yourself. Like, what is that song?
No. There's so many songs. But I think, the stupid one, I was going to say if it was just, like, a basic theme song, I was like, just Zoe won't compromise, so it should be a Jay-Z song. But I'm a huge Sinatra fan as well as a Jay-Z fan. And I would say, like, something like Me and My Shadow.
Nice.
Yeah,
because it's so, they're so goofy. It's such an inappropriate song. In 2014 for a black man and a, well, even more inappropriate for a black man and a white woman.
Well, I would never suggest that, Zach.
Yeah, no, but I think
you can.
Yes, I can. That's one of the benefits of being a gay black man.
Yeah.
I think that Kanye would do better if he had a Zoe Chace or vice versa.
Nice.
Because I think we both keep each other. Because in this world, this public radio world, it is crazy behind the scenes. And
you cannot go it alone.
Yeah, you cannot. And so you should see how crazy we... Crazy, there you go. That one.
Yeah.
Because we're always talking about like how Zoe has her kind of crazy and I have my kind of crazy, and they're complementary, but mm-hmm. they're not the same. And so we'll be like, don't send that email. Because that's just, let me edit that email before you send it. Or, and so I think that's, you know, like we need each other to keep, like, the balance. Like, if I were not to be in public radio or something like that, I don't know. You know, Zoe would do fine. She just would be a little crazier and vice versa.
I love it.
Or people would be exposed to my craziness more than they are because it has a sonari filter over it.
And vice versa.
Oh, man. Every, you know, it's just one big metaphor. Every Zoe should have a sonari and vice versa. The energy that you two have. I was not planning on doing these interviews together, but we have to have you two back. I now only want you guys together on the show.
Well, remember, we're radio producers, so we know what sounds good.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Because we're going to have you back. We have all of our, you know, the celebrity gay couples that we've had on have played the newlywed game. I think you guys at some point are going to have to come back and play it as well.
That sounds pretty gay.
Pretty gay. We'll give you a chance to win some swag. The energy is just fantastic. Look, you guys are just the pinnacle of examples of folks out there using their voices, and I will take exception with something you said, Zoe, earlier, that you are making a difference. You are using your voice. Both of you are telling stories that either we don't know about or casting things in a much different light and giving us context, and that is world-changing. You really are focusing our attention on just the important things with your own spin on it, and it's just so enormously appreciated, not just by all the tons of people who listen to public radio, but as an avid listener to you both. It's just incredible what you both do.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So can I tell you something before we wrap up?
Oh, yeah.
So you know what's going to happen, right? We're gonna hang up, and then I'm going to go to my desk, and then we're going to both say, you weren't terrible.
Can't I just tell you both that you weren't terrible? Do you need each other to validate that?
Yeah. I need to hear from Sonari.
Okay. Okay.
It's just totally screwed.
I think our listeners, and certainly me myself, are always wondering, gosh, what do our guests do a few minutes afterwards? And I love the fact that this is the first time in 245 episodes that I know exactly what's going to happen right after this. That's awesome. That's awesome. Folks can stroll on over to npr.org. You can type in both of their names. We'll provide links. Listen to what it is they do, because it is just a great thing. Sonari, Zoe, what an absolute treat having you both on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Me and my shadow, strolling down the avenue.
All right, folks. Well, we are back with another amazing guest for you. Number three for this week's episode. It's crazy. Jason Doody is a nationally recognized comedian who has appeared on Logos, Wisecracks, the Outlaugh Comedy Festival, and as a finalist at the World Series of Comedy 3 years in a row. His debut comedy album, Major Doody, is both a critical and commercial success. You can stroll on over and get it on iTunes. He's a regular at some of the greatest comedy clubs in the country, including Flappers, The Laugh Factory, Zanies. He is the creator and producer of the hugely popular Come Out Laughing, a touring comedy show featuring Dana Goldberg, who was on the show a few weeks ago, Ian Harvey, who's on next week's show. But for this week, it's Jason Doody. Jason, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
It's so gay.
Do you feel it?
I feel like you're really gay, Ken.
What about you? Let's do a little self-analysis. How gay do you feel right now, Jason?
I'm pretty gay.
All right.
I'm driving from Los Angeles in a tube top. hot pants and cork wedges, so I feel kind of gay.
Well, Jason, we will start with you as we start with all of our funny people. Tell the world, tell all of our listeners, where does Jason Duty find the funny?
Jason Duty finds the funny in observation. Most of my act is stuff you've all thought of in your head, and you didn't say it. Most of my act is like, everyone sits there like, yeah. Yeah.
But I have watched your comedy. I have seen Jason Duty do comedy. Where would your act be without your family?
Oh, right. Which, again, is observational. I just watch these people. It's ridiculous. I don't know where my act would have been, but I will tell you, every time my mother calls me and says, I've got something for your show, it's never funny. You know? But if I just watch her and listen to her, it's hilarious.
I love that that's going to be the narrative thread that we're going to find through all the comics we have on our show. Aaron Foley said the exact same thing last week. Dana Goldberg said the exact same things 2 weeks ago.
Well, right, right, because our parents can't see the funny in the everyday thing. Their everyday life, they don't think it's funny. It's hilarious.
I love it. Well, let's skip right to the gay part. Tell everyone how the being gay part contributes to what it is that you do on stage.
All right, I've got a weird career, I swear. I play about 60% in just rooms throughout the country. It's not gay, it's just a room. I'm so fortunate. Like, I love doing those clubs. I do a lot of celebrity cruises. I love doing them. And I am that guy. When I do a whole gay crowd, that's my favorite, of course. They're my people.
Nice.
But when I do a crowd of just middle America, they like me like 10 minutes into it, and then I say something about my boyfriend, and then you see them just pause. Like, did he just say he was gay? Yeah, I did. I did. Now what? You already like me. Now what?
Exactly. Now, it's funny that you just said that you enjoy playing for gay audiences. Some of your colleagues said that they don't much care, but that sounds like something that you rather enjoy.
I enjoy it. It's so much harder. It's so much more of a challenge because gay audiences, we've seen it all. We've done it all. We know extreme talent. We know extreme performers. So it's a challenge.
Yeah, I bet. We've heard a lot about, Jason, from your female counterparts, just about how male-dominated comedy can be. Talk to me about what is it like for a gay man. So, yes, it's male-dominated, but it also strikes me it's probably pretty straight male-dominated.
It is very straight male dominated, and a lot of the times I'm in the green room in these comedy clubs, and the guys are talking about their wives and the chick they banged last weekend and all this stuff, and I just sit there and I'm real quiet, and because I love being the quiet one in the green room, just real quiet, and these comedians I haven't heard, like comedians, some of them that aren't very good, they tend to like just joke all the time, just joke. I just sit there and I'm real quiet, and I hit the stage and just slam it.
Nice.
And then they have no idea what to say when I come backstage.
I would imagine that's led to some very interesting interactions with your colleagues.
Oh, absolutely. Like, some of them will say when I come off stage, I had one guy say to me, this other comedian, like, hey, that's great. I mean, I didn't know I was hanging out with a gay guy all night, but really, I don't have a problem with it. I was like, really? Because I don't really like hanging out with you.
Love it.
It has nothing to do with you being straight. You're just a schmuck. That's all.
Well, as I said in your intro, you put together this Come Out Laughing tour, and we had Dana Goldberg was on the show. She's freaking hilarious, and Ian Harvey's going to be on the show next week, and he's hilarious. Tell me why you wanted to put this together.
It took me a long time. I knew I wanted to travel with a gay show. I knew I didn't want gay or super fag in the title. You know what I mean? Like, I knew I wanted something that would bring everybody. And so maybe Come Out Laughing, maybe we trick a few of the straight people. That's totally fine.
Right.
It took me a while to find the right people. And by tap and chance, Ian and Dana and I did a show a couple years ago in Albuquerque. And right when the show ended, I was like, oh my goodness, that's it. This is it. These are the three. This is it. Gay, lesbian, transgender. And I was like, this is it. And then it just took off. I just was waiting. I mean, I started this thing in 2008, and I, you know, several people in several different cities, different comics and all of them were great shows, but this show takes it up a notch.
Nice. What kind of audience reaction have you been getting?
Great audience reaction. And what I like, it attracts everyone, the gays, the lesbians, and the transgenders, and we always have straight people that come.
Yeah.
They've loved it. It's, I mean, I don't want to talk about Ian and Dan, but it's all different. And we're all, our acts are so different. I'm very loud and observational, and Ian is so funny, but you're also learning about transgender when Ian's on stage.
Right.
Very to be funny about a topic that's so, you know, current and a topic that people need to learn about.
Right.
So, Ian is just, she's just funny, that's all.
What are we learning from Jason Duty?
You know what we're learning from Jason Duty? Just be yourself. That's what you're learning. Just be yourself and take a moment and laugh. I do this joke about the self-serve checkout lane.
Yes.
Now, these things are irritating to everybody in this entire country. But no one stops to, like, just be like, this is ridiculous. And get more jokes. I get more people coming up to me after the show saying things like, oh, my God, I hate that self-serve checkout lane. Yeah, yeah, we all need to say something. It's ridiculous.
Now, you had some fun coming out stories. I've been listening to your comedy. You were anticipating different reactions from your mother and father, were you not?
Well, you know, they could have been a little bit more dramatic. They could have been a little bit more shocked. That would have been nice. That would have been something besides, that's great. You know, you're gay. You still have to do your chores. Like, there was nothing. I wanted some story to, like, live the next 20 years telling people how horrible my parents were when I came out. Nothing. I got nothing.
How do you process that?
I know. It's like, what do you mean you accept me? You're supposed to not accept me, and then I'm supposed to fall in some depression with drugs and alcohol and sleep with a million people. I mean, I did some of that just because I wanted to. But it was just weird. They were just like, okay, fine. And I guess my dad was more accepting than my mom. And everyone thinks, you know, my dad's a military guy. He just didn't think he was going to do it. But he did not care at all. I was so raised with how you behave and manners. And that was so much more important to my parents than who I sleep with. They could care less. But if I left that house and I didn't behave, that's a whole other story. And it happens often.
I love it. I love it. Well, I love having comics on. I love hearing about the highs and the lows of what it is that you all do, because the traveling is just so incredible to me, and just getting on stage and not knowing what kind of audience you're going to get. So let's cover the highs and lows. Give me just that Jason Duty career highlight where you look back and say, you know what, that was the night that I killed it.
I opened for, by chance, I opened for Louis Anderson in Vegas one night.
Nice.
And I have had this thing for Louis Anderson my entire life. You know, he's observational, he's family, he's clean, he's hilarious, he's lovable the moment he hit stage. And afterwards, he just shook my hand and he sat down and looked eye to eye, and he was like, you're very funny. Just in his Louis Anderson, I was like, oh my God, Louis Anderson just said, you're very funny.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's...
Great fan and great supporter, and I've been able to email him with questions. He's been so kind to me.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great to have that support. So that's one of those highlights. What was one of those nights where you're like, oh my gosh, that was a little bit rough out there?
That would be in one of our southern states.
Okay.
And I was on stage, and there was this huge commotion in the back, and I didn't know what it was, and I was kind of a new comic, so I didn't address it. Today, I would address it. I'd be like, what the hell is going on? But I didn't address it. I just went through my act, and then I came off stage, and the owner of the club was in the green room, and I was like, well, that's weird. He just looked at me, and he said, look, we've gone to your hotel. We've packed up all your stuff. We're moving hotels. And I was like, what is happening?
Whoa.
Well, there was an audience member that was furious. He paid money to see a homosexual.
Come on.
No, he was furious. And the way their advertising does, it says, you know, the guests, the comedians of such and such club stay at this hotel. So for my safety, they moved my hotel.
Wow.
I know, it was crazy.
You didn't have to go on again after that, did you?
Not that night. No,
okay.
That was it.
Okay.
That was a Friday night. I mean, he didn't come back Saturday night, I guess. And I don't know how they handled it. I do appreciate the fact that the club had my safety and my best interest in mind. It did wake me up a little bit because I didn't understand. I still forget that there's people that dislike homosexuals, don't like us. I forget.
Right.
So it was a good reminder.
Now, has your family come to see you on stage?
My gosh, yes. My family comes to see me on stage. My mom brings all her doctors, the oncologist, the dentist, the anesthesiologist. She brings all her doctors. Yeah, they come every time. And then she interrupts the show by saying, I hear her in the audience going, it's true. That's totally true. I did that. That's true.
It's fun to get that validation right when you're there on stage.
Yeah, maybe she could save it for later. You know, I am working.
Well, I have to tell you, I enjoy listening to Major Duty very much. What kind of reactions did you get to that?
Well, it was my first CD. I enjoyed it a lot. I'm so ready for my second one because I think I've grown a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I got great reactions to it, but I think, to be honest with you, I think I played it a little safe.
Oh.
Like, I just did clean jokes, which are funny, but I think my second CD is going to be a little bit, not raunchier, but I'm going to be a little bit exactly what I'm thinking.
Okay. And so when's that coming out?
Well, that is all in the process. We're going to... Dude, I had a little hiccup in my personal life. You know, I'm getting married next month, so I got to get married first.
So exciting. Now, I would imagine, what does your partner do?
My partner works in nonprofit. He spends his whole life and all of his college degrees helping people. I want to help people, blah, blah, blah.
I would imagine that were you to write your own vows, and I don't know if you're doing that, that I would be a little bit nervous if I were him.
Oh, I'm totally writing my own vows. No, absolutely writing my own vows. Yes, 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 yes.
Does he set parameters for you?
The only parameter he said has to be in there was till death do us part.
Okay.
Well, I said, who's death? Who's death? And then I'll say that.
I love that you need specificity on that. Oh, that's so exciting. We love a fun wedding. Where are you getting married? We want to hear the details.
We are getting married in Los Angeles on February 8th at the Silent Movie Theater.
Ooh.
I know. It's kind of fun. It's just this real, like, old theater where Buster Keaton used to play. And it's a quirky little location. I'm very excited about it. Like, all the invitations you had to read, you had to put 3D glasses on to read the invitations.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Now, what pieces were you in charge of, and what pieces were you like, oh, there's just no way I'm doing it?
Gosh, I don't want to do any of it. what am I in charge of? Oh, I'm in charge of non-wedding activity over the weekend.
Okay.
Like, it's the dinner with all of our family together, an open house at our house, anything not concerned with the ceremony and the venue, that is my department.
Okay. And he's in charge of everything else?
He's in charge of everything for the wedding. We have only had a few little... No, I don't want that. But it's okay. It's okay.
Okay.
It's coming around.
All right.
It's coming around. It's hard to do a wedding because everything costs money, and then you got to remember the bang for the buck, what is important, what's important to us, what are we really doing to make other people happy.
Did he give you a time limit for the vows?
No, but there is a stage, and he will not get married on the stage, so we're getting married in front of the stage.
Okay.
And I was like, why get married on the stage? He goes, because I know you on a stage. If you're on the stage, the whole wedding's going to be about you. I'm like, oh, maybe.
Oh, man, I love the idea that they pass you the microphone to do the vows, and you say, you know what, I'm going to get to that in a second. I was at the supermarket this afternoon. That would be amazing.
Oh, he is the most patient, loving, kind guy ever. Like, I can save all of my humor for most things. The wedding, I'm going to have to reel it in a little bit.
Okay. I would also perhaps, just unsolicited advice, I would perhaps recommend not calling it a hiccup in your personal life anymore.
Oh, right. That's good, Ken. That's good.
I'm here to help, Jason. It's a self-help show as well.
Right. Well, it's not really a hiccup. It's just, you know, it's scheduling thing.
It's a scheduling conflict.
Oh, I don't know. Wait a minute. I guess I'm still not getting ready. It's like, the wedding of my dreams, or I don't know what I'm supposed to say.
Oh, man.
I looked at him this morning. I was like, are you sure? Meanwhile, I had like two different socks on. I couldn't find, you know, my jacket. I knocked over my coffee all over the kitchen. I just looked at him. I was like, are you sure? You're positive. You want to do this.
When you're going to have to ask that to him is February 8th, 2015, when you want to celebrate the one-year anniversary of your hiccup or the scheduling conflict.
All right, I won't call. Oh, I hope he doesn't get to Ohio and hear this. Okay, I won't call
it. We're all over the country, so he can hear it anytime.
Oh, that's right. You guys are everywhere. Wait, did you say the dates where we're going to be everywhere?
I'm going to tell them right now. It's like you and I rehearse this. Because everyone listening, you can go see Jason Duty on January 25th at 8 p.m. It's the Come Out Laughing Comedy Tour. They are playing at the Wall Street Nightclub in Columbus, Ohio, right here in Ohio. You excited to come to Ohio?
I love Ohio. I know people are like, real. They always pause. They're like, really? I mean, there's something about Columbus. I love Cincinnati and Columbus. Those are the two cities I love.
Nice.
I don't know why. I like the people.
Well, that's where you're going to be. January 25th, the Wall Street Nightclub, Columbus, Ohio. Dana Goldberg, who you've already heard on the show. You'll hear Ian Harvey next week. It is the Come Out Laughing Comedy Tour. Look, have the most amazing February 8th ever. May it be the most joyous hiccup scheduling conflict you've ever had. Our best to your partner, and you guys just have so much fun in Columbus.
Oh, my God. Just tell everyone, check out all of our dates on comeoutlaughing.com. And thank you, Ken, and I hope I get to meet you. I do.
I'm going to try to make it to Columbus. I've never been there, but it's not that far away, so I want to come see you guys.
Oh, my gosh, it's so much fun there.
Awesome, awesome. So stroll on over, folks, also to jasonduty.com, jasonduDEY.com, and find out where they are playing. Jason, what a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you, Ken, and thank you for my my life lesson.
Here, anytime you need help, I am here for you, Jason.
Okay.
Three quick news stories for you before we conclude this week's episode. Attention is now on Oklahoma. A federal judge in Oklahoma ruled this week that the state's constitutional amendment barring same-sex marriage violated the federal constitution. This is the latest in a string of legal victories for gay rights, and one that occurs, I mean, come on, in Oklahoma. So that's a really big deal. The state's ban on marriage by gay and lesbian couples is, quote, this is what the judge has said, an arbitrary, irrational exclusion of just one class of Oklahoma citizens from a governmental benefit. That judge is Judge Terrence C. Kern of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Oklahoma in Tulsa. And he was deciding on a case. You ready for this? It had been languishing in the court system for 9 years. 9 years. I am so thankful that there are LGBT rights advocates who are doing this work, who know what they're doing enough that they can shepherd through a case that has been languishing for 9 years. I can't even imagine that, how you're just trying to push that through and how frustrated you must get. So great job there in Oklahoma. Of course, the other side, however we want to characterize the other side, will not let this stand. There will be an appeal. You have the guy who heads up Garden State Equality. He's decided to step down from Garden State Equality there in my home state of New Jersey to head on out to Oklahoma to help the fight there. So we will, of course, keep you posted on Oklahoma. On the other side of the world and on the other side of the spectrum for LGBT rights, this being about as severe of oppression as you can possibly get, dubbed the Jail the Gays Bill, a bill in Nigeria further criminalizes homosexuality and will endanger programs fighting HIV and AIDS in the gay community. There are men that have been targeted by the police, then tortured, and it's all in accordance with the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act. It's getting international condemnation, even from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who said this past week, quote, "Beyond even prohibiting same-sex marriage, this law dangerously restricts freedom of assembly, association, and expression for all Nigerians." It's being dubbed a witch hunt. It's pretty bad in Nigeria. It is pretty bad in Nigeria. The government is on board with it. We will see if the U.S. will intervene. You know, the U.S. certainly makes strong statements about these things, and you got to question, do we want to get involved in every scenario and all over the world? Maybe we just won't go to the Olympics if it's bad in Russia. We won't send our presidential delegation, but we're certainly not going to abstain from the Olympics. I know I'm a little upset, actually, that I just got from this horrible bill in Nigeria to the Russia bill, which is not as bad, but it's still pretty bad. And it's just still something we're figuring out. We're a country that's figuring out how we interact with LGBT rights. And then we have to figure out, oh, how will we interact with LGBT rights abroad? It's not something that we figured out. It's not something we figured out here. It's not something we figured out abroad. So there's that. In the best story of the week, a United Methodist Church congregation in Alexandria, Indiana. You might have seen the story because it went viral there on the Facebook. It dwindled by 80%, this congregation, after the church forced out its gay choir director. I love this story. Adam Fraley told the Herald Bulletin that he lost his job because of his sexual orientation. Fraley, who attended services with his partner but was not open about his sexuality while working at the church, he held the position for 6 years. He resigned in the spring, saying that a new minister made him uncomfortable. In September, David Mantor was appointed as new interim minister. David Steele, who represents the congregation, asked Mantor to bring back Fraley. Mantor initially agreed, but 3 weeks later he fired Fraley and the following day told Steele he could no longer serve. Steele refused to quit, but church leaders backed Mantor. Church law states that non-celibate gay couples cannot be appointed to serve in the United Methodist Church. Anyway, it started going back and forth and back and forth, and a large majority of the church's congregation sided with this ousted choir director, and they left this church, and their congregation dwindled by 80%. And heck, you gotta love that we have congregations out there that will stick by their tried and true members who are doing such great work in this beautiful way. And obviously, it's not my favorite story because some of the events, I don't really like the part where someone gets fired, and I don't like the part where 80% of a church has to leave a congregation from which I'm sure they derived large amount of comfort and strength and faith and all of those great things that they needed. But at the same time, it's a show of solidarity that the rest of the world really does need to see. And I love that everyone's sharing it on Facebook. So if you see that story out there, please continue to share it, because it will make a difference. That is it for this week's episode. A little bit of news, some great folks from NPR, a hilariously funny comic. We're done. That's it for this week. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?